Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories.
Don't warn that tyranny is always lurking just around the corner. You should reject these voices.
You are free to do as we tell you. You are free to do as we tell you.
But I want to say one thing to the American people.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again.
They don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't care about you at all.
Outrageous conspiracy theories.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Beard World Order. I am your co-host, Guillermo Jimenez, the Traces of Reality.com. With me, as always, is James Corbett, CorbettReport.com. And on this episode, we're doing a little something different. We've got a special guest with us. Mr. Dan Dix of Press for Truth is here. Dan, welcome to the Beard World Order. How you doing, man?
Very well. Thank you for having me on. It's great to be in the company of such wonderful beards.
Well, thanks for being here, man. James, how you doing, man?
I'm doing all right, and I'm glad that we were able to get someone in who does meet the requirement for beards. But I must say, Dan, I think your beard has been more impressive in the past. It seems like you're really shaving it tight these days.
There was a time when it was a little more enchanted than it is now, so I've cut back on that slightly, but it still holds power, trust me.
I don't doubt it.
I think we were all quite fond of the enchanted Dan look, but this works. This works. This is good.
Good.
All right, I guess we'll get right into today's topic, and sort of in keeping with the theme, the general theme of this show thus far. In our first episode, we talked about uncorking conspiracy and all that entails. In our second episode, we covered the idea of meta conspiracies and conspiracies within conspiracies and all that fun stuff. And on this episode, we're going to talk about what could perhaps be considered the mother of all conspiracies, Bilderberg and secret societies. And so I'd like to say here at the outset that while I personally find these issues extremely fascinating, I am by no means an expert on them. So when it comes to things like perhaps the origins or the influence of these individual secret societies throughout history, I might defer to you guys on that stuff. But to get started, actually, on that note, I wanted to ask you guys, kind of throw this out there to both of you and see how you want to go about this. Should we start with sort of a general introduction to what we're discussing here with Bilderberg specifically, or should we just jump right into the advanced course for our audience here?
I think we've got some advanced listeners, and if they want more on Bilderberg, maybe they could look at my Bilderberg, Why We Must Oppose Bilderberg podcast from this year, where I went into some depth about the origins of the group. But I think probably everyone out there is at least vaguely familiar with that.
Yeah, they have an idea of what we're talking about. Excellent. Okay, so let's start this way then. So let's start with recent history. Just this past year, Bilderberg 2014, Copenhagen, Denmark. Dan, you've been covering this stuff actually for a couple of years now in person. So I wanted to get a sense from you, first of all, you know, what took place this past year, maybe perhaps some key figures that were in attendance, your experience, of course, along with Luke Radowski and all of that happened with security and whatnot. And then perhaps we can maybe go backtrack a little bit. I'm actually curious to hear from you specifically about what your experience has been like in the last few years and how you think Bilderberg itself may have evolved, perhaps with the times, let's say, or perhaps its perception has evolved. So your thoughts on that, man?
Sure. Well, I think both sides of the Bilderberg group conferences has evolved. The meetings themselves and the protests that take place at these meetings. The first time I ever went there was in 2006, and it's a completely different world than it is now. Last year in London, I mean, there were thousands of people showing up. This year, it wasn't quite thousands, but there were still hundreds of people, but a huge, huge difference from back when I began attending in 2006. So that just goes to show the effect that we're starting to have, and that people are beginning to pay attention to this organization, and more people are starting to show up to these things. Now, as you said, on the other side of this, Bilderberg in recent years have even been forced to have to publish some of their information by putting it on a website. In fact, at this year's conference in Copenhagen, Denmark, I had a rare opportunity to confront the chairman of Goldman Sachs, Peter Sutherland. And when I asked him about the agendas that are being discussed there, he says, "Well, they're all published, my boy. They're all out there." And you know, so that's an interesting video, actually. Myself and Luke Radowski, if you guys want to check it out, it's I think we called it Chairman of Goldman Sachs confronted at Bilderberg in Copenhagen or something. But We get into it in depth with him as well, and they kind of cowered and ran away from that one.
And let me recommend that video as well. It is actually quite entertaining, but also, I mean, informative to watch the way that they attempt to try to engage with what you're saying, but really more as deflection. Although it was the person who was with Peter Sutherland, I can't remember who that was, who really attempted to engage you more in that conversation. But again, it was interesting to see the way they kind of dismissed what you were saying, because again, it's all open, it's all on the website now.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. The young gentleman there was from Ireland. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but it was his first time ever attending. And I wanted to take the opportunity, because we'll get into this in the show, but I wanted to get into him with this fact that I happen to think that there's somewhat of an inner circle within the inner circle. You still have to get invited to these things. Not everybody who attends Bilderberg is necessarily aware of some sort of nefarious agenda or trying to set up this New World Order. So I kind of warned the young guy and said, you know, just be careful, because the people who invited you here may be trying to scope you out and try to feel you out, see if you're going to be willing to play along or not. And that seemed to bother Peter Sutherland. That made him quite uncomfortable. But I took the opportunity to warn the young guy, be careful. I'm not saying you're doing anything nefarious. Some people are in there and they may try to corrupt you.
So, well, let's use that as a jumping off point for how to really start to scrutinize this, because I think it's important when we look at something like Bilderberg to apply the same institutional analysis to that we would to any other organization or grouping, because ultimately I think it functions in a similar way. And I think you point to what I have long taken to be the core operating principles of groups like Bilderberg, which is that they are, as G. Edward Griffin put it in a lecture I always go back to, rings within rings. I mean, this is the fundamental structure that they rely upon. And exactly as you say, there's 125 to 150 invitees to Bilderberg each year. I certainly don't think all of them are in on the agenda of the core grouping, and I don't think they all necessarily understand or agree with all of the things that Bilderberg talks about. And we often see people who are invited to the conference once and never again. I certainly don't think that makes them part of the inner group of the inner group. And the question, of course, is what is that inner group? And of course, with Bilderberg, we have an identifiable structure for that. We have the Bilderberg Steering Committee, which is the core group of 15 to 20 people who really do decide. They, for example, extend the invitations and get to decide who attends and who doesn't and what the agenda is. So quite clearly, just like any other institution, we can analyze sort of the structure of this and the way that it functions to try to identify where the power actually lies in that organization. And to a certain extent, that demystifies this, I think. It's not, you know, some, you know, hooded people in robes chanting around a fire or something. This is,
isn't it?
Although that actually does take place in other secret societies, which we'll get into. But in this case, I mean, it really just functions like any sort of, I mean, I guess you could look at it as like a mafia type meeting where you might have I'll go back to Dick Tracy because that was a formative movie from my childhood where you get the mobsters come together at the table and they don't like each other necessarily. They have different sections of the geography carved out for their own turf, but they'll come together for the table to talk about how to divvy up that cartography and what have you. And I think that's one way of at least trying to look at what's going on at Bilderberg. And perhaps that gives us ways of looking at how to actually effectively counteract what they're doing. Because again, I don't think it necessarily serves our interest to point to someone who's been invited once and to say, you're the evil New World Order. Perhaps there is an actual opportunity for education of people who are potentially on the fringes of these groups, or for the public at large, that what we're seeing is not necessarily that this is just a monolithic organization that itself is inherently evil, but that there are certain people at the core of this group who clearly do have an agenda.
Interesting. That's an interesting way to look at it. Yeah, the competing agendas within the group, but generally the overall agenda is maintained. As long as we have more for ourselves and less for everybody else, you know, we're happy as long as we can divvy it up for ourselves. You know, we'll debate about, you know, how much you get and how much I get. But as long as, you know, we're in this together, so to speak, I suppose that's the way it generally flows. I wanted to just kind of jump on that a little bit and then throw this to Dan. But that's kind of what I was trying to hit at. And that's what really is interesting me now about this more and more, the demystification of the group. And whether or not that's simply, I suppose, a window dressing in a way, or whether that is taking some of that power, so to speak, away from this group. the fact that they do have an official website now, the fact that a lot of this is being covered now, even in the mainstream media and things like this. So does that, to either of your minds, but I want to hear from Dan first, is that having any actual tangible effect on the way the group operates, you think, or is that just, you know, for show?
Yeah, I think so. I think the days of when things being discussed around that table, let's picture 120 people in that room sitting around that table. I don't think that necessarily that's when the major things get accomplished at Bilderberg. I happen to feel, now this is speculation, mind you, but we're kind of forced to have to speculate about these things sometimes,
yeah,
is that a lot of the things get done when a guy like Peter Sutherland takes a young man like this MP from Ireland and goes on a walk, or when a Henry Kissinger or David Rockefeller takes somebody aside and maybe sits them down at the bar in between the meetings and has a little private chat. That's where we can, that's where the real power lies. And there's examples where we can see this in the Canadian connection to Bilderberg. At the meeting in 1996, there was Jean Chrétien, Alan Gottlieb, Paul Martin. And this is just a small example that all of these guys had something to do with signing various trade deals, for example. Chrétien with the NAFTA, Paul Martin with the SPP, Alan Gottlieb with all of them, North American Free Trade Leaders Summit. Now, do these guys know that they're being involved in the setup of a future North American Union? Not necessarily, but they're all playing their roles and playing their parts. Maybe they do know, maybe they don't, but they may not understand even themselves how the dots are actually connected, but it's the inner core, it's the inner steering committee who know the true agenda, I believe.
Well, okay, and so I think what we're identifying here is the way that the power operates in groups like these, and I think it sounds like we have a consensus on that it probably does function more as a result of a small group within the group who have that sort of power and the ability to function by basically compartmentalizing the rest of the group. And I think, yeah, I agree exactly with what you said, Dan. I mean, someone like a Chrétien or a Martin is a useful political puppet to have in a position of power to sign the treaties that need to be signed, and they may agree with what is professed to them as an ideology. Well, we need, you know, more cooperation because of this, that, and the other. They don't necessarily know where this is going in the end, in the way that someone like a Rockefeller, for example, explicitly wrote about in his biography. If that is a globalist, then I am a globalist and proud of it, or whatever he said.
Yeah.
So, yeah, exactly in that way. But I think then what we perhaps should be looking at is the way that this compartmentalization idea developed from the idea of intelligence agencies. I mean, I think that's the way that, for example, the CIA or the NSA or these other groups, as a loud speaker truck drives by in the background, I'm not sure you can hear that. I think that's the way that these intelligence agencies function, is through compartmentalization. So only a very few people within those agencies have any idea what the broader agenda of that is being aimed at actually is, and everyone is just serving their one little role. And I suppose if we draw this back away from just Bilderberg itself to the larger question of secret societies, I mean, I think that ultimately secret societies are and were the basis for intelligence agencies. And I think we see a lot of connection between those and the way that those function. So I think whatever institutional analysis that we're bringing to the table when it comes to something like Bilderberg is the same type of analysis that we should and could fruitfully apply to something like the CIA or the NSA. Because again, it's not that every single person involved in the FBI, for example, is knowingly a part of a plot to create terror plots in order to bust them or what have you, but that may be the sort of institutional, the way that power is institutionally wielded by the few people in the positions to direct that organization. And again, I guess I want to bring this back to what can we, on this side of things, fruitfully do to resist that, because again, these are the people who are in positions of power, both political power, like the Chrétiens and the Martins and what have you, and also the economic and financial power, which perhaps underlies the political power.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to understand how this ties into all of it. Like, just like you said with the intelligence communities, if we want to take this back to as far as ancient secret societies, I mean, one of the most famous probably being the Freemasons. I mean, we know that there's compartmentalization. There's less and less that you know in the lower ranks, and you begin to get more knowledgeable in the organization as you go through. Albert Pike even wrote in his book that the first 3 degrees are but the outer portico, and they're there, you know, just for show, basically. But the true meaning of the symbols to masonry, for example, are held for the adepts, he says. And so there's always this concept of an outer ring, and then there's an inner, more esoteric ring that has the true knowledge. And like you said, let's look at how this operates in Bilderberg and intelligence communities and secret societies, because it seems to be a key way to operate. These conspiracies can't work when there's too many people being involved. So it's compartmentalization with knowledge at the top and less as you permeate your way down through the organization.
Now, that reminds me of something I wanted to ask you, Dan, actually. Both of you said something that reminded me of a point that I wanted to raise before we move on from Bilderberg specifically. The issue of intelligence agencies kind of reminded me of this a little bit. And that's, I had a conversation about this not too long ago with on the BFP podcast with Lee Camp, and he brought up something that sort of an obvious point, but I hadn't really considered it before. And that's, I guess we already sort of touched on it, but that's, you know, the sort of information and technology age that we live in. And the fact that if, for example, the CEO of Google, say, you know, Larry Page or Eric Schmidt or whatever, if he wanted to set up a little chat with the Queen of Spain or something and a couple of their buddies, they could probably pull it off. They could probably set up some kind of secure video chat and do this, you know, with technology these days. So, you know, why, even though, and what I wanted to ask you about is being in attendance, and I know that most of the attendees that you've interacted with very much do not want to be on camera, let's say, or have their, you know, they hide their faces and whatnot. But I'm wondering if perhaps the symbolic nature of all this, if perhaps maybe perhaps even speaking of circles, this maybe more applies to that outer circle that we're talking about. If perhaps some of these guys don't get a kick out of this, I mean, why all this, you know, cloak and dagger shit if it's not really all that necessary? What do you think about that? What do you make of it being a sort of symbolic thing for again, a lot of these guys who are maybe first invited probably get a thrill out of, you know, rubbing elbows with some of these inner cats.
Well, I think you might be right about that, but I think that's not to dismiss that idea. I think that actually just bolsters the insidious nature of this, because I think to a large extent it probably is about that display of power and
right.
wealth and intrigue and, whoa, you know, now you're part of the big club. And I think that can be used as a motivating factor in influencing some of these people who might be in positions to wield authority to implement the agenda. So I think there's probably something to that. I mean, as an institution, it probably does function by being that sort of elite, wow, you're part of the in crowd now. But let me raise my own kind of devil's advocate position here. Well, not my own, actually. I'm going to read from a post that was up on RT this year. It was an op-ed by Dr. Rosalind Fuller, who has lectured at Trinity College, Ireland, where I actually studied for a year. So there you go. Although I don't know this person. But she wrote an op-ed saying why Bilderberg is the least of your worries. And I'd like to solicit your guys' opinion on this. I'll just read a couple of paragraphs from this. She says, people are rightly concerned that business magnates and top politicians are conducting conversations like jobs, entitlement, and debt in private, along with challenges for Africa, which, considering the complete absence of African attendees, says a lot about whose challenges in Africa are going to be discussed. My guess would be that Chinese and Western leaders attempted to carve out their respective roles on this resource-rich continent. Which is interesting, because I don't know if there were Chinese attendees this year. But anyway, I think we can all agree that these politically relevant conversations should be happening in public, and that your ability to enjoy an occasional cocktail schmooze with politicians should not be tied so tightly to the size of your bank account. However, where critics go wrong is in seeing Bilderberg as a cause instead of a symptom. Bilderberg is an important conference, particularly when it comes to coordinating transatlantic strategy, but it is only one of literally hundreds of meetings between business and politicians on the calendar. Most public international organizations like the UN or WTO invite thousands of non-governmental organizations to their meetings, and while they work hard to give the impression that these organizations are but the humble representatives of the slaving global proletariat, some of them are, after all. Many, possibly even most, are offshoots of big business or government-financed strawmen. And then she goes on to give examples like the International Chamber of Commerce and other such things, which are institutions which are out there in the open and very obviously for the promulgation of certain business interests and do are the type of grouping that bring these powerful people together in meetings constantly throughout the year. As she says, hundreds of meetings throughout the year of this sort take place. Why then is Bilderberg seen as the core of this, or why is it of particular note? And I suppose I have my own response to this, but I'd be interested to get your guys' take on how do we address this concern.
Well, what I think is interesting about how a lot of these groups operate, going back to everything we've just said, is a lot of times it's all about order out of chaos. You were mentioning, you know, why, you know, nowadays you could set up these types of meetings over Skype or something like that. Well, today, funny enough, is actually the 4-year anniversary to the day today of the G20 in Toronto. And that's a good example. People often wonder, why do these organizations show up to these towns? Everybody knows how dangerous they are and how hated they are. Couldn't they have a meeting on a yacht somewhere? Couldn't they have it on Skype? Well, sometimes they want that clash. Sometimes it stems down to the order out of chaos sometimes. And that very well could be what's going on with Bilderberg as well. I don't know if that addressed what you were mentioning there, Jay.
To a certain extent, yeah. Guillermo?
No, yeah, that's actually, that was the question that I had. It's sort of similar to what, I think we lost Dan for a second, maybe not. I think I lost both of you, actually.
I'm here.
Oh, okay. Well, you were perfectly still. So I could,
sorry. I could, Dan also is just being perfectly still. No, he definitely did drop.
Yeah, it was going to happen. It was going to happen. This is why they meet in person, because they don't want to deal with shit like this. That's
yeah.
Why. I think Dan answered the question that I had basically as to why perhaps these guys decide to meet in person, because they have to expect this, right? They have to expect that natural curiosity that stems from all the secrecy. They have to expect that now, again, this information age, that people are going to organize, people are going to show up, people are going to have their cameras and do all these things. They have to know all this. They're not stupid, of course. And so, yeah, that you do have to wonder, then why? Why do you go through with it? And to my mind, it does seem like it's, again, we're speculating, but I guess if I wanted to psychologize these people a little bit, I would say that they must enjoy it to some extent. It must be symbolic in some way to hold that much power, I suppose, to be able to just, you know, 100 of these guys meet in one place and, you know, all eyes on them for a short time. That must mean something to them on some level. As far as your question, James, about I don't know who this was again, the person you were reading from, but I guess there's something to that. I guess I have the same sort of question as far as what makes this event more special or unique than any other congregation of the world's elite. Is it all the secrecy? Is it because it's been kept for so long out of the public eye, and only recently have we learned more and more about it? Is that what has made it special? Is the inherent secrecy is what made it so special, or is it unique in and of itself? And I guess I want to throw that to either of you to get that to sort of answer.
I'm not sure. I guess it's possibly a bit of both. Really, I don't know, James.
Well, I suppose my response would be to agree with what this Dr. Fuller is writing in this op-ed. I do think that Bilderberg is not the cause so much as the symptom of a larger phenomenon that does take place throughout the year. So in that respect, I don't think it's any more deserving or less deserving of any other particular grouping of being exposed and subject to the same type of scrutiny. However, I mean, one thing you could say is that Bilderberg probably is slightly more elite than a lot of these other conferences that take place, just in terms of the firepower of the people that they're able to bring together. There aren't a lot of conferences that are of that caliber, and the extent of the secrecy that goes on surrounding this does. I mean, again, in this day and age, as we say, in the information age, it is, I suppose, different now that it's sort of slightly been let out of the bag, and there is at least some, there was a fair bit of media coverage last year in England, and it was talked about on national TV, so it's not exactly functioning in the same way that it did 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, when it was truly, completely, 100% off the radar of almost every single person on the earth who wasn't an attendee. I think it did function in a certain way back in that era, and it's functioning in a different way in this era. But so I think that the secrecy aspect to it is part of what makes it interesting from the perspective of people who are looking for something to cover. But I think the other thing is that I think we need a focal point to direct our attention to, and I hope that it doesn't stop at the, well, we must oppose Bilderberg. I mean, I hope it continues on to the logical conclusion that we must be opposed to these types of confluences of power and meetings and secret compacts that are entered into behind the scenes, no matter when and where they're taking place. And just as an example of something that is potentially, I mean, as ominous, or at least in the same league of ominousness as Bilderberg, it comes from Andrew Gavin Marshall, who wrote an article at about the same time as Bilderberg this year. Back on the 2nd of June, he wrote an article about the International Monetary Conference, which is not something I was familiar with before reading this article, and I would venture to say most people in the audience aren't either. But he does this, he's doing a series on the IMC and who they are and where they meet and all of this. And basically, a lot of the attendees from Bilderberg packed up their bags in Copenhagen and then went to this International Monetary Conference that was taking place in Munich. So it's even some of the same people are involved in this. And again, it's a nefarious conference of central bankers and private bankers coming together, talking about banking regulations and things of that sort. Again, a similar kind of grouping of power talking about issues that would best be served if there was some scrutiny to these issues. Why isn't the IMC getting anything like the kind of scrutiny? Why isn't it even known, let alone the Bilderberg conference? But then again, if the IMC became the focal point of our protest, then there'd be another organization, right, and another and another. I mean, I think the point has to be more of an institutional analysis of how these groups in general work, and I think Bilderberg is a very good focal point to that, because again, it comes around every year, and every year people can sort of concentrate their firepower on it and hopefully have an effect on that. And I think that's doubly effective because, again, not only does it hopefully actually undermine what they're doing at Bilderberg to whatever extent, but then I hope it also helps to encourage the resistance movement. Because, again, the more success that we have, the more that we understand that the power really does lie with us. And conversely, the more failure that we have, the more that people get disheartened and demotivated and basically disengage. So I think there's reasons to concentrate on a group, and why not Bilderberg? I mean, it is, an important and influential group, and I think it does deserve the scrutiny that we're giving to it, like many other organizations do. But I think that would be my answer.
Excellent point, man. Good point. Dan, anything else to add to that? Or shall we move on to... Nope. Some other secret societies. You're speaking of things that or people or gatherings that meet yearly. Another secret society, I guess no show on secret societies would be complete without bringing up Skull and Bones and Bohemian Grove, right? So why not bring that up? And I believe, and to your point, James, about the focus on Bilderberg rather than other gatherings, I haven't really read much of anything and I about Bohemian Grove, and I believe the gathering is already underway. I think it's a part of it happens in early June, and another part of it happens in early July. And I wanted to get maybe some general thoughts from either of you about this, somewhat secretive gathering. It's still fairly secretive, although many of these things, again, just because of the nature of information these days, are more accessible to the public. But yeah, generally, and then we'll get into some specifics. But maybe Dan, let me get your thoughts on the Bohemian Grove. What do you think about that, man?
Sure. Yeah, well, it's important to pay attention to all these groups, just like James was saying. And, when you have somebody, an organization like Bohemian Grove, where these same people, we sometimes refer to them as a triple threat or quadruple threat, whether Bilderbergers, CFR, Trilateral, IMF, they're all these guys. When you find that they're going to things like Bohemian Grove, and then you look into what sort of things do they do there, what sort of things go on at Bohemian Grove, it's incredibly eye-opening into a much bigger agenda about this whole New World Order agenda. It really opens up a bigger picture when you see that these guys are actually involved into some very occult ritualistic ceremonies that take place there, namely the cremation of care, where a body, an effigy of a body, is placed on the altar in a fire. and it's consumed. It's called the cremation of care, and it's burned in front of an altar in front of their god, which they refer to as Moloch. And the cremation of care, I think, is symbolic of almost killing off your God-given conscience and showing that you're willing to do something like this in order to give way to the cares of the world. And I think, you know, I always looked at Bohemian Grove as like an Illuminati summer training camp, you know, where they kind of test you out if you're willing to do some of the darker side of things, you know, some of the occult things that are involved in the New World Order agenda. So it's kind of like a training school for that, and kind of testing the waters to see who's going to be willing to play along and dabble in the darker arts of the New World Order agenda.
James, your thoughts, man?
Come on, Dan. You know it's just kind of a frat boy spring break for the elderly jet set. I mean, this is nothing nefarious. No, this is, I mean, Bohemian Grove specifically is an interesting example of that phenomenon of how we can become normalized to ideas that beforehand would have been really, really hard to even accept. I mean, I remember the first time I heard the concept that there were, I mean, literally high-ranking politicians, including presidents, who, you know, meet in the woods and do these occult rituals. I thought, what a ridiculous, that's so ridiculous, I can't even, that just couldn't possibly happen. And then you see the footage that was snuck out of there, and the first time I encountered that, it was crazy. I'm like, I can't believe this actually happens. And now, fast forward several years, and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm Bohemian Grove. Yeah, they do that every year. So there is a process of normalization that goes on with that. Yeah, it's not that important, really. When perhaps it would serve us well to maintain some of the initial reaction that we have to this. But I suppose, well, again, let's play some devil's advocate with this, because when Bill Clinton was confronted once by someone, I can't remember the context or what the person was talking about, but one thing that he brought up was Bohemian Grove, and Bill Clinton said, oh yeah, that thing where Republicans go and run around in the woods and piss on trees. Yeah, I'm not a member of that. And I suppose to a certain extent he's right. I mean, it is predominantly a Republican institution, and all of the politicians and others who are identified with it are certainly right-wing, right-leaning. There aren't any high-ranking Democrats that I know of. Certainly all the presidents that have been associated with Republicans. So maybe this is just a kind of a political kind of left-right thing. Maybe it's nothing to do with, you know, some sort of overarching agenda. I'm not necessarily making that argument, but I'm sure that someone who's trapped in that left-right system could make that argument. So what would we say to that?
Interesting. No, yeah, that's a good point, man. And to your point earlier, though, about how this has become normalized, I think you're absolutely right. And I think I have to check myself even, because I think it's happened to me as well. I know exactly what you're talking about. When I first heard about it, you're like, holy, are you serious? They're really doing this out in the woods and nobody knows about this. And nowadays, yeah, it does seem like, well, okay, is this really a Luciferian death cult, or are these just a glorified elitist douchebag summer camp, as Dan was saying earlier? And again, I wrote a little tongue-in-cheek brief article on this last year when I heard that Conan O'Brien was in attendance. Conan O'Brien worships Moloch? Question mark, really? I thought that was really strange, and it made me question both Conan O'Brien, first of all, what is he doing at Bohemian Grove? But it also made me question the club itself, and it made me for a second I thought to myself, well, okay, is this really the Luciferian death cult that I've always thought it was, or is it just a glorified a club, as you say, for maybe right leaning politicians to go out, blow off some steam, and perhaps while they're there, maybe, you know, dish out what their latest you know, plans are for whatever they might be, you know, scheming up. But yeah, I think. Both of you made a good point about this, and I have to check myself, because it was really, really creepy the first time I heard about this. The cremation of care, of course, though, as you mentioned earlier, James, the black cloaks, all of that is present there. And it is something that I guess we should not just brush off as something innocent. So, Dan, your thoughts on that, man?
Well, when we see that similar things happen in other organizations, other societies like Skull and Bones, and Freemasonry, a lot of ritualistic ceremonies, and these types of things go on in other organizations, I think it's safe to say that it's not necessarily all just simply political here, or just a bunch of frat boys getting together having fun. When we're seeing this all across the board, I think it's evident that there's a bigger picture at play here, and that it's not necessarily completely all about money and power, although, you know, that's a large part to do with it. But a lot of these guys who are running the show, they have all the money. They print, they make the money. They have all the power. I think this agenda sometimes goes beyond money and power. And when you see that these guys are interested in the occult, maybe that means that there is actually something to this. These are very smart, intelligent people who have gotten to where they are for a reason. So I think there's definitely something to it, as opposed to just a bunch of frat guys getting together, especially, like I said, when you see it all across the board in different secret societies. It's evident to me that there's more than what meets the eye here, and that what we can see with our eyes.
Let me see if I can chart a middle ground then between those two positions. It's not just drunken frat boys, and it's not necessarily they're opening an interdimensional portal to the netherworld or something. Maybe there is something in between that, insofar as you're right. These are intelligent people who have come to positions of power because they are brutal and ruthless, mostly, but also because they're not stupid people. I mean, these are people who have spent a lot of time trying to understand and trying to use systems to their own advantage and have been successful in doing so. So I think we have to take the types of rituals that we know they engage in seriously, at least to the extent that this is not something that just kind of came about by happenstance. But I think what this might indicate might be that, again, a sort of fundamental understanding of human psychology, and that humans like ourselves, sitting here on the outside speculating about groups like Bilderberg and others because they're secretive, it provides that kind of mystery, which in it hooks us in, it entices us. And I think that psychology is something that's played on with the occult. So one thing we could imagine, at any rate, again, this is speculation, but one thing we could imagine is that these types of groups fundamentally operate like, I imagine, secret societies always have for thousands of years, and like intelligence agencies do today, by always providing people with the idea, you know, there's something going on here, and you don't quite have access to this knowledge, but maybe if you play the right cards, you can get closer to the sort of core understanding, and we'll let you in on the mysteries, which, of course, is explicitly how Freemasonry works with its degrees, and, oh, maybe you can work your way up to the 33rd degree, and you know, all secrets will be revealed. And similarly with these types of occult rituals, it might be more as a psychological tool to impress these people who might be invited into, you know, you're on the outer fringes of the inner circle. Do you want to get into the inner circle and, you know, harness the true power of Satan or whatever, whatever they're trying to offer these people? And I think that, I mean, I see that the occult aspects of it, potentially at least, again, this is speculation, but functioning in that manner as sort of a basically a psychological leverage tool over people. Because again, exactly like the shamans and, you know, thousands of years ago would, you know, stop the snake god from swallowing the sun because they know when the eclipse is coming and they know when it's going to end. You know, it's a powerful thing. If you just have more knowledge than the other person, and you can convince them that knowledge provides you with some sort of access to the spirit world or whatever, you know, I mean, it's a powerful tool and a leverage that you can use to further increase your control over other people.
Not to mention the brotherhood. You know, a lot of these are referred to as a brotherhood, and just having a common brethren. You know, so knowing you can go world and enter another country in another particular building and have somebody there who has been indoctrinated or believes the same things that you do probably gives them a sense of it's kind of like you said earlier, like a mafia, like a family, like you're really, really a part of something that's bigger than what you are. So you're right. I think a lot of it is psychological, grabbing them psychologically as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I guess in that sense, and that's how it resembles that fraternity that we've been kind of tongue in cheek referring to, that sort of brotherhood that these guys are bonding and it's a sort of, you know, special union and they can, you know, rely on each other. And of course they do. Of course, this is something we can observe in business and in politics, the way favors are delivered to work your way up the ladder. A lot of this has already been, you know, pretty well documented. I wanted to ask Dan something. This is kind of an aside, but it's still related. Because we mentioned earlier how you were attacked, I guess, by security at Bilderberg. Not the first time, of course, and not that long ago. You were thrown out of CPAC for trying to interview Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich, of course, very famously attendee of Bohemian Grove. curious what you make of that, man. And if that had anything to do with you being thrown out of that joint.
Yeah, it's funny enough. I almost forgot all about the fact that I was in line to confront Newt Gingrich on the fact that he attended me in Grove. And it was there at CPAC, and I don't know, I was in the line for maybe 10-15 minutes when they just came straight up to me, a couple guys in suits. They got a little white thing in their ear, and they come up and they say, "You, out of the line." And they pulled me aside and were checking my pockets, checking my ID, and they just said, "We know who you are. We know what you're here to do." And they just kicked me out and said, "If I don't leave, I'll be arrested." The exact same thing did end up happening this year in Bilderberg when those hotel clerks held me down there after we confronted the organizing committee. One of them said, "We know who you are and we know what you do." And you can hear me in this video say, "You know who I am? What am I trying to do? What do you mean you know what I do?" I don't know. I don't know how much info these guys have on me, but both those times I was set aside as I was, doing something. And the second time I ended up getting full blown arrested, taken downtown and put in the police station in Copenhagen, Denmark there. I don't know. Maybe that's a sign that me and Luke are onto something here if they're recognizing me in Copenhagen, Denmark. But it kind of sucks because it's hard to do the job when they when they notice you and just pull you out of the line like that.
Well, right. Well, let that be sort of a reminder to the audience that when there are as few of us as there are who are vocal and out there and in front, you know, really vocally opposed to Bilderberg and putting our names and our faces out there, yeah, I would be surprised if Bilderberg security did not know about you and Luke and other people who are there year after year. You know, I mean, it just makes sense that they would be aware of who you are and what you do. So again, it's just a reminder that when there's a few of us out there doing it, it's very easy to identify and you know, use us as a lesson. When there are hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, it would be impossible. And again, it's that question of reaching that critical mass. But again, let's bring this back then again to what we can do to oppose these types of groupings, because this is something I always think about, is what is the actual solution to these types of things? Because I don't know, I'm not going to speak for you guys, but I think we probably all agree with the voluntaristic principles that whatever voluntary associations people want to enter into, as long as that doesn't involve the use of fraud or force and aggression on other people, is fine. I'm not going to tell other people how to live their lives. But then what gives us the right to demand these people not meet together? I mean, there's a couple of ways of looking at this, I suppose. I mean, there's the political aspect. We may not agree with the political groupings that exist or politics as it exists, but it exists. And as these people are elected representatives, then yes, I think the public certainly does have a right to say who and when and how they should be meeting and conspiring with people in positions of power. But going beyond that, I mean, when we look at something like a Skull and Bones or even a Bohemian Grove, I mean, these are organizations where it's just people who are coming together to relate to each other. So what would we do to stop that from happening? And you could look through history. I mean, there was the Anti-Masonic Party, which was the first third party grouping in the United States. It really started the party system in the United States as we know it today, and party platforms and nominating conventions, and all of that resulted from the creation of the Anti-Masonic Party, which was an entire political party that was brought about explicitly because they wanted to get rid of Freemasonry. But the question is, how do you do that? I mean, what do you actually do? Do you make a law to say that, to go specifically against a group like the Freemasons and say no one can be a Freemason? Well, that seems a bit arbitrary and ridiculous because, again, they just call it something else and meet in a different way. So do you make it so that people can't meet in private, or what do you actually do about this? I have my own opinion about this, but I'm interested in soliciting yours.
Well, I think global non-compliance is the answer. It's not about projecting will onto others. It's just simply stepping out and saying, I'm not going to take part in this system. And there's a lot of different ways that people can do that on the individual level. If you want to really affect this thing, the best way is to lead by example, and hopefully others will follow your example. And there's a number of things that people can do on the individual level to step outside of the system and to just not comply with all of the things. Namely, I think one of the biggest ones, and maybe the most difficult for a lot of people, but probably the most important is to get out of debt is absolutely key. I think when you have mortgages and a line of credit, and multiple credit cards, and you know, it's getting really bad these days. Some people are up to their neck in debt. The elite have their hands around your neck and they can squeeze at any time. So I think focusing on how you can individually step out of these systems, you know, homeschool your kids, don't own any debt. There's things you can do on the individual basis. And I would just say that that's what it comes down to, leading by example, not telling somebody else what they can or can't do, but simply saying, you know, I choose not to take part in any of this. Hopefully others will follow my example.
Yeah, good point, man. And I agree with Dan on this as far as what we can do individually and collectively as a response to these things. And I think just to go back to what we were talking about earlier, it's a really good example of how it's having an effect. The fact that you were accosted a couple of times now because they said to you directly, you know, we know who you are, we know what you're doing. It's an example of how, what you, James, to your example too, about how the part of the power is that secrecy. It's part of that shaman-like, like as you were saying earlier, that power that they wield comes from that. So when that is removed, part of that power is removed with it. And so, and I know I was saying earlier that some of these guys must get off a little bit on, you know, hiding from the camera and whatnot. But I think generally, I think it is true that by removing that power, by shining the spotlight, by putting a camera in their face, that is in itself having a tangible, observable effect. Also, as far as your point, James, earlier about the need for some sort of law potentially, and I don't know the specifics of it, so I can't speak about the details, but I think there is a law on the U.S. books anyway, the Logan Act, right, of course, about meeting, I don't know if it's in secret or what, but meeting with other world leaders and whatnot. But what you raised, James, opens up a can of worms for me, because this might take us a whole nother hour to discuss, but... as you were talking, I was thinking about this, and it's really interesting because you were saying that I think it's true that part of the reason why people are so upset that these things happen, that these secret societies exist, that meetings like Bilderberg occur, is because that a lot of the people there are elected representatives of the people. And so because of that, in this sort of system that we currently have, we need to hold these people accountable because they're acting in our name, right? Now, hypothetically, if we were in a stateless society, right, and these people are no longer elected representatives, these secret societies obviously do not go away. They persist, and to some degree or another, they're going to continue meeting in these ways. So then, in that sense, what leverage does the public then have to demand accountability for these people? Or, as you say, should they just be left alone to their own devices? After all, they're organizing voluntarily. And meeting, even if it's in secret, what right would we then have to tell them to do or what to do or what not to do? So I wanted to throw that back to you because I'm actually curious about this. What do you think
about
that?
Well, actually, I think what Dan said perfectly answers what you're saying, because in the free society, in a stateless society, it would precisely be our individual choice to for example, buy from company X or to contract with bank Y to make a deposit or what have you. It would be completely our choice. There would be no state telling us, for example, that there's a legal tender law saying that you must have this type of piece of paper in order to pay your taxes and be a legal human being. So that we would have complete choice over what we do. And so, yes, I mean, certainly politicians and or not politicians, sorry, businessmen and financiers and whatever else, you know, people in positions of influence and wealth could meet together and presumably would meet together even in a stateless society, but we would have complete control over whether or not we want to interact with them. I suppose the operative part of that would be secrecy, because again, if these people are doing this in secret in a way that no one even knows about it, then that's I suppose a type of fraud being perpetrated on a public that would presumably need to know about what's being done by these corporations in order to decide whether or not you want to contract with them. But again, ultimately, So I think really my response would be the combination of what you two guys talked about. So first of all, I think exactly right. It is about what we can actually do about this. And that really is in terms of what we can do to get off of the system that they use to wield their power over us, which is exactly, it's debt, it's control of education, it's all of these things that they do have control over that we can actually make an active choice to comply with or to find ways around. And then also, yes, if they function by secrecy, if secrecy is so important and vital to what they're doing, then clearly the exposure of what they're doing is in itself an answer to what they're doing. And that's, I understand that's not satisfying to people. They want some sort of more overarching response to this. But I think the exposure itself, it really does undermine their ability to implement their agenda, because it's an agenda that only functions, again, by keeping information from people. If you have more information than other people, you can always use that as a leverage. So if you create an international grouping like the European Union with a single central bank, even though you have, you know, 28 different states or however many are in the Eurozone, with all with different economies, and you try to set a single monetary policy, and you know that is doomed to failure, but you can use that failure that you know is going to come about as a result of that grouping to argue for even more power. Well, that means we must make it into a single governmental body. We must give more power to the ECB and make the EU into a real government. If that is indeed your end goal, then all you have to do is dish it out bit by bit by bit. Oh no, it's not a European Union. We're just entering into some trade negotiations. And okay, it is a European Union, but that's all. I mean, it's just a way to talk about things between states. Okay, no, actually it's a European Central Bank. And yes, we're going to have a single currency, but that's it. I mean, you keep your individual governments. And now, oh, well, no, you don't need your individual governments. I mean, you just lead people through the agenda. So again, exposure of the agenda at the beginning is important, because exactly like with the Bohemian Grove example, if you tell people, you know, these politicians are meeting in the woods and doing these rituals and things, people are like, what? You're crazy. But if you just reveal it to them bit by bit by bit, and then they get used to it, that's the way that this functions. So exposure of secrets is absolutely vital to this. And again, what we can actually do to get ourselves off of their pressure points, which is usually around the financial system and the education system and other things that, again, we can choose to whether or not we want to buy from their corporations or whether we're going to find ways around that. The only point that we really don't have any leverage over at this point is the monetary system, which, again, I mean, we can choose not to abide by their rules, but that'll get us locked in a cage. So, I mean, I think that's really one of the fundamental points that we have to concentrate our firepower on, because it is truly a point at which they have a stranglehold over us.
Indeed, yeah. Indeed. Yep. No, and excellent points all around, guys. And I think also, James, just to your point quickly, but I think not only is it not psychologically satisfying to not have an overarching answer for all this, but also to suggest that people should take individual responsibility for their actions and not take on debt, as Dan suggested, and things like that. That's not what they want to hear. What are you going to do for me? I don't want to. That sounds like a lot of work. I don't know about all that. But
and just to make a more nuanced point, I think that in a stateless society, in a free society with free human beings, again, it doesn't necessarily mean that there won't be such things as credit or what have you, but it just means we have to be responsible for who we're contracting with for credit. And if you enter into a contract with a bank or whatever for debt, then you have to understand what that institution is and what they're doing with your money and who's really controlling it and all of that, which in our current system, we feel we don't have to, because in the US, there's the FDIC or similar institutions around the world that take that out of your hands. Oh, don't worry. The government backing up your deposits.
We'll take
you know, don't worry about who you're contracting with. Bank A is as good as Bank B. Don't look into it, and don't think about your personal choice in this matter. So it's not to say, again, necessarily that all of these things are evil and must be completely rejected. It's just that we have to be very consciously deciding where we put our money, who we interact with, what we do with our time. And the fact that they're trying to take that choice, not take the choice away from us, but try to make that choice meaningless, I think, again, shows that that is something that we need to be concentrating on.
Exactly.
Like a true free market. These guys would have been weeded out, you know, weeded out long ago if we truly had a free market.
Exactly. Yeah.
Indeed, indeed. Now, guys, it's about that time to wrap this up. So closing remarks from each of you before we close out the program. Dan and James, anything else you'd like to add either about this or just generally? I'll start with Dan here. Anything you would like to say before we close out today's show?
No, I mean, fascinating topic. Thanks for having me on to talk about it all. Again, it's of the utmost importance to understand what all these organizations are doing, especially when it goes sometimes beyond money and beyond power. So we have to pay close attention to what they're doing. I've been paying close attention for many years now. If people want to check out my work, they can check it out at pressfortruth.ca. And of course, the YouTube channel is youtube.com/weavingspider, which is a little note to the Bohemian Grove, actually. Weaving spiders come not here is their motto. So you can check that out on YouTube. And that is about it.
And of course, we will put the links to some of the videos we've been talking about, your arrest at Bilderberg, your confrontation of Peter Sutherland, and some of the others that we've been talking about in the show notes for this. And also, I would just like to, as always, encourage viewer response, listener response to this, to get your take on what we've been talking about. Of course, you're a vital part of this conversation. And on that note, we should go over some of the feedback we received from our previous edition of Beard World Order, where we were talking, for example, about the DOD and its assistance of various movie projects. And on that note, we had an email in from Alf who said, regarding the DOD-assisted movies, the Department of Defense-assisted movies, isn't it a smart thing to do if they want to hide their intention to assist a lot of movies that are about flowers and stuff? It would be stupid to only assist obvious movies. So I think that's a fair point. Obviously, the DOD does want to be involved in a lot of different projects so that the ones that they really want to influence don't necessarily stand out so much. Also, Bruce wrote in to say, regarding the Beard World Order, thoughts from a viewer, why your broadcast style works. Number one, your calm approach pulls as opposed to pushes your audience to think. Two, you stress the rational thought process. Three, you remain open to opposing views and opinions. Four, you present yourselves as real, ordinary people without reliance on ego, title, or station. Five, you continue to cover very diverse, interesting, and controversial subjects. And six, lastly, you provide links so the listener viewer can check for themselves and are free to draw their own opinion. So thank you very much for that, Bruce. And finally, we had in from Jason regarding Karate Kid 2 and the Department of Defense and Okinawa.
It's a strange one.
Yes. Why were they involved? He says, I think they were involved because it involved Mr. Miyagi's return to his home island of Okinawa, an island where nearly everyone still there has an ancestor who was killed in the Battle of Okinawa by an American Marine. Which is a fair point, and also it continues to be an ongoing concern for the people of Okinawa, many of whom are very much opposed to the U.S. military presence there, which continues to happen despite many, many political assurances that it would be moved. So certainly I can see some sort of DOD connection there in trying to make sure that that script certainly excises any such mention of any of the cultural factors around that. But I don't know if I've even seen Karate Kid 2, let alone even if I have, I certainly don't remember it, so I'm not speaking from any particular viewpoint there. So anyway, thank you for all of that feedback and view and input. And of course, you can all contact us via our various websites with feedback about this conversation.
Indeed, indeed. Good stuff, guys. Good stuff from the audience. Again, really, really good stuff. Appreciate the feedback. And it's been well over a month since our last episode. So we will try to make this a more regular thing on a monthly basis. And we do really encourage, I want to echo what James said, encourage your feedback, encourage your emails. Topic ideas, of course, are also welcome. I'd like to know what you guys want us to talk about for the next show. We've got a month to send those in, so please do so. I guess that about wraps it up for this episode. Again, thank you guys for joining me. Yes, the links will be on the show notes. The links to our respective websites and ways to contact us each will also be in the show notes. So, again, please do that. Come back and join us next month, we hope, we think, right here on the Beard World Order. Thanks for listening.
The very word secrecy is repugnant. In a free and open society.
You are free to do as we tell you.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Well, we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy.
The Beard World Order.